Grouchy lecture. No. These are the wrong notes. This is number 14. Apologies, I have to go and fetch number 15. That looked too familiar. Okay, here we go again. We looked yesterday at how the path integral construction of the non-relativistic particle kind of could be carried over to gravity. Now, of course, the object of interest, kind of the analogs of the one-dimensional path of the particle case, are now curved four-dimensional space-times, given by their intrinsic curvature, their intrinsic geometry. Okay, however, what we saw that we could take over was this character of just having, making them kind of piecewise flat. And in this case, one regularized them in the sense that giving you a curved geometry just consisted in giving you a bunch, a finite bunch of data, of length variables, of edges, and how these triangular building blocks are glued together to give a simplicial a manifold. Okay, I said something about how curvature is encoded in those. So here I brought a little demonstration for you today, again, of this business with the deficit angles. So these are six, so we are in two dimensions, right? So these are six flat triangles meeting at a point, and the deficit angle, well, if I glue them together, was just 2 pi minus some of the angles that meet here at this vertex. So here it's, of course, it would be 0. If I take out one of the triangles, well, then I obtain a surface that is not just extrinsically curved, but intrinsically curved. So if you were a two-dimensional being that lived inside the surface, you could detect that there is non-trivial curvature. And of course, it's located at this point in a kind of delta function-like manner. And how could you find out about it if that is curved? Well, you could perform parallel transport of a vector, right? So, and here I've drawn the little arrows for the vector. So they are parallel transported everywhere. But you see, of course, if I glue only 5 of them together, then there is a mismatch here between the directions of the two here. I should have, you know, I noticed I should have pointed the than the other way, but you understand what, you know, what I'm trying to say. So as a matter of fact, of course, the angle by which this vector appears rotated is exactly equal to the angle I've cut out here, right? So it's really a direct measure of curvature. And in higher dimensions, you just sum over all kind of two-dimensional planes, and for each of them, you measure this deficit angle, and then you add them all up. And this way you get kind of the Reggie version of the curvature. OK, so we will now look at a path integral where the histories are represented by these triangulated manifolds. And I furthermore said, well, we concentrate on a version of that where we keep the edge lengths fixed and we vary the way in which these triangular building blocks are glued together. And kind of the prescription is to glue them together, say, for a given number of building blocks in all inequivalent ways. And that will give you then so many, of course, for a finite number of building blocks, it will give you a finite number of ways of doing that, of configurations you have to sum over. these equilateral triangulations one is using in the contour theory, they wouldn't actually be any good in the classical theory, because they, that's also in reaction to a question some of you asked yesterday, they don't really nicely approximate kind of arbitrarily well in a kind of in a pointwise manner, arbitrary smooth continuum spacetime. But here in the path integral, that is absolutely of no relevance in the sense that at any rate, what your path integral will turn out to be dominated by are things that are very, very far from any classical configuration. So actually, our expectation is kind of looking at the particle case. So what will happen, you know, if you perform this sum and we take some continuum limit? Well, we're really expecting that the superposition will be dominated by highly singular configurations. So the superposition of spacetimes in this non-perturbative way of doing it will be dominated by, so I loosely speaking call that kind of the 4D analogs, whatever that is, analogs of the nowhere differentiable path of the particle case. And of course, so they will be highly singular, that's certainly to be expected. That's also, I mean, the very same thing happens even if you look at, you know, a quantum field theory. So it's not the smooth classical looking configurations that play the dominant role. And of course, you can imagine that in four dimensions, there are many, many more screwy ways in which the geometry can go singular than for this just one dimensional path. So this is what one expects to happen. Things that are certainly on small scales, very singular and wiggly. However, of course, on large scales, you do want to show that classical geometry is recovered in some way or upon averaging. OK, I finished by writing down the path integral. Now, our prescription for what this is in this ansatz of dynamical triangulation is given as a continuum limit of a sum over inequivalent triangulations, some configuration space with an upper cut of n, 1 divided by ct e to the is the Reggie action. So the nice thing about this is that for finite values of these parameters, this is just finite. It's just a finite sum. Of course, I'm interested in looking at this in a specific limit. Now, this is not the problem that people first try to solve, certainly not in no dimension, as a matter of fact. So what people tried to do instead, also seeing being alarmed by the presence of these oscillating quantum amplitudes, they simply substituted this problem of the sum of a Lorentzian triangulated spacetime, if you like, by the same problem where you substitute, just in an ad hoc manner, you can say, this configuration space here by the configuration space over triangulated Euclidean spaces. I mean, space-times would be the wrong word, because there is no time. Yeah, so substituted here a Euclidean, used kind of real Boltzmann weights with a kind of Euclidean signature here up in the exponential, and solved this problem. So that is then a Euclidean path integral, which you have already met in Gregory's GR course, I believe, possibly elsewhere. I'm just emphasizing it's a different problem. So there is no easy way of relating this with the Lorentzian way of doing the sum. So that's kind of Hawking's prescription for doing quantum gravity via the Euclidean path integral. Now, so you can also try and play this through in this specific definition of what you're going to mean by the gravitational path integral in this regularization. Now, this works quite beautifully in d equal to 2. So then you can essentially kind of, well, analytically in a specific scaling limit, you can just solve, you can just evaluate this explicitly and recover something that's called Liouville quantum gravity. So that's was a hot topic in the early 90s, to which many people contributed, including François David, who was the lecturer here in one of the QFT courses. Now, so this system can also be solved. I mean, it's sufficiently simple that you can almost do the continuum path integral, okay? And well, kind of in a bootstrap way of setting things up, this is due to Kawai and Distler. And if you can compare the two, so what you get from using this prescription to derive the quantum gravity theory and use the continuum path integral, where you then, of course, have to gauge fix. You have to take into account kind of Fadeev-Popov determinants, as we've learned. Then for quantities, which you can compute in both approaches, you find they agree. So that is quite nice in the sense that it provides you, it reassures you that this method in principle works. Yes. So there you have it's a toy example, but nevertheless it's a quite non-trivial example where you happen to be able to also do kind of the continuum construction and compare the two things, and they are, as far as you can see, they are the same. Now, unfortunately, if you then try to do the same Euclidean quantum gravity construction in higher dimensions, then it turns out that this method, I call it EDT, kind of for Euclidean, dynamical triangulation, it has no good classical limit. Actually, it wasn't immediately apparent to people who worked with these models, and they were just studied numerically by Monte Carlo methods. That's the key way to try and understand these models in higher dimensions. It wasn't at first noticed that there was something wrong, say in d equal to 4, with this model, that it didn't actually give the correct result, until one discovered so there was some serious flaw in the kind of ground state or the solution, the quantum space-time that comes out of this construction. And of course, I told you here, you expect the path integral to be dominated by very, very singular structures. But in this Euclidean setup, it turns out the structures are too singular. So they're so singular that there seems to be no way of recovering a four-dimensional extended geometry from them. So here I have another little, it's hands-on quantum gravity today, another little demonstration. So you see what happens is that if you look, you know, like we said, we looked at the path integral, the weak rotated path integral for the non-relativistic particle. I told you, well, actually mathematically rigorously, one can show that it's dominated by these Nova differentiable paths. Now, if one looks here at this construction in this limit, there are two possibilities, depending on how one has chosen one's bare coupling constant that, of course, enter into this model. There are two possibilities of kind of what kind of history dominates this path integral. And the first of them, well, is the so-called crumpled phase. So the crumpled phase has gives you a quantum universe that has basically dimension infinity. Now, what's an infinite dimensional space? An infinite dimensional space is one with a very, very small linear extension, but a very, very high volume. So kind of it pretends to be a much higher space. What comes out is a much higher dimensional space than the one you put in. So you put in four-dimensional building blocks, but it turns out their preferred way of arranging themselves is just to crumple together densely kind of around a point. So everything, the universe is tiny. In one or two steps, you're everywhere. And that's, of course, that's a property of a very, very high dimensional space. And in the limit, is it actually infinite dimensional? So conversely, there is another phase of the statistical model where another type of geometry dominates, namely polymeric geometries. So what are these? They're kind of, then your four simplices, they arrange themselves into branching polymers that are kind of locally just one-dimensional objects. And of course, that's a phenomenon very familiar to string theories. So here, my demonstration is just for this surprising finding that dimensionality can change after you've taken this non-trivial limit from the dimensionality of the building blocks you used to construct these quantum geometries in the first place. So how can this happen? Of course, so imagine our building blocks were two-dimensional sheet of paper. So if you crumple it up, so that would give you a crumpled face, and it becomes tiny, tiny. It pretends it's now an object that looks three-dimensional. Yeah, it's a slightly hand-waving analogy, but conversely, so that has changed its dimension to three now. Not infinite, but three. And of course, conversely, every string theory knows how to roll up dimensions, right? To curl up dimensions. So, oops, that was a two-dimensional sheet. Now, this should have come out a little thinner. Maybe from the back row, it looks almost one-dimensional. So that's the way geometries can behave. So that's de facto what happens in these Euclidean quantum gravity models. So unfortunately, these structures are really too singular, and no matter how we look at them, kind of to extract any nice classical limit that would remind us of classical GR. So they have the wrong limit. Therefore, they are just the wrong series of quantum gravity. So I should point out this is an unusual situation that you can actually, you have a theory that is so concrete that you can actually falsify it. Yes?
I'm curious, what's the solutions for two dimensions, and why don't they have these problems that higher dimensions do?
Yeah, in two dimensions, well, of course, it's not in two dimensions, these, again, are not really physical theories in the sense that you can relate them out, to what you see in nature. But what happens in 2D for these Euclidean models is that the Hausdorff dimension actually comes out to be four. So what comes out here? The polymers that you find in higher dimensions, 3, 4, and higher, one of the phases is just dominated by these branched polymers. These objects turn out to have Hausdorff dimension 2. Why? Well, kind of say, locally they are one-dimensional, but the fact that kind of in any point they can branch out kind of accounts for the second 2 here. Now, the geometries that dominate neural quantum gravity are kind of a blow up of these things. So you can think of them as being kind of locally two-dimensional, but branching everywhere. And well, it just gives you an interesting model. Of course, is it physical? Well, the question doesn't pose itself, but you can think of it as a bosonic string theory in zero target dimension, something like that. So it's just a theory of two-dimensional surfaces, a non-perturbative path integral, which has some intrinsic interest also in the context, of course, these appeared in physics, so and in the context of conformal field theories, and then you can couple matter to these objects, and well, it's the whole paraphernalia of models you can study there, and they're all highly non-trivial. Of course, but it's a different issue, right? This is not solving quantum gravity in 4D, but it's kind of non-trivial toy models that certainly have taught us some interesting lessons of what can happen to to geometry when you make it non-perturbative. So when you really allow non-perturbative excitations very, very far away from any classical geometry. So things like dimensions that appear kind of out of nowhere are dynamically generated, like, and are not canonical, meaning not as you would expect them to be from the kind of type of ingredients you put in there. They appear. Okay, now, so that's the wrong theory of gravity, for sure. Yeah?
So you said that for 2D, you build quantum gravity, or you build, yeah, I should say 2D, you build Euclidean quantum gravity.
Yes, it's Euclidean.
You get geometry, like average geometries with Hausdorff dimension 4.
Yes.
Okay. And
sorry, it might be one of these other dimensions. I forget now, spectral or fracture. Yeah, yeah, but this is the tip of what I told you. I mean, this is basically true.
Okay. Yeah. And so you said it sort of, in a sense, it doesn't matter like what building blocks you start with. Like you can sort of tune them so they self-assemble into things of other dimensions.
Well, no, one cannot really make such. Well, it's true. I mean, for this Euclidean model, what is very interesting beyond d equal to 2, these two possibilities, these types of degeneracies, they occur very generically. So that's, and that really, even the dimension of the building block is irrelevant.
Okay.
So that's kind of very curious.
So can you remove the dimension of the building block from the model entirely? Like, can you just?
No, you can't. I mean, then you don't know what to do. I mean, you really have, of course, you have a specific way of constructing these series, which start with certain ingredients, which starts with an action in principle,
right,
with, you know, a notion of entropy.
And there's no way to write the action in terms of more general properties of the building blocks. Okay.
You could try, but you see, the problem is, of course, if you try to make to perform sums over a class of objects that is too general, there will be no way you can ever make out of this, sense out of this, makes it, well, regularize it perhaps, but renormalize it in a standard way and get kind of finite results. So if the number of your configurations, like say here these curve geometries, if it grows faster than exponentially with the volume or the number of building blocks you're putting in, then you're in trouble. Then generally, these will be non-Borel summable series, and you simply have no idea of how to extract, in general, how in a unique way to extract finite physics from them. Okay, let me move on. Of course, you know, I wouldn't be talking about this if there wasn't a cure. So the cure is, it turns out, not to do things in the Euclidean domain, but really go back to the Lorentzian picture and make these dynamical triangulations causal. So this is not going to work. So we have to go to the previous picture. And of course, then one has to face a number of technical problems of how to do this. So how does one bring in causality in this picture? Well, in two ways. Of course, first one uses now Minkowskian building blocks again, as I told you. So we just cut out our 4D triangular building, but we cut them out of Minkowski space, so they have light cones in them. And of course, we may have to make sure that kind of the light cones, they're glued together in a consistent manner. I mean, I'm not gluing a light cone that goes this way with a light cone that goes that way. So there has to be some kind of continuity of doing this. So the Lorentzian nature is encoded in the Hughes building blocks. In the causal case, so use Minkowskian building blocks and glue them together kind of consistently. Well, this is just a little sketch, kind of what you would be doing in 2D. And secondly, it turns out what one has to do in order to improve on these kind of no-go results in the Euclidean theory and has to introduce a notion of time. It will turn out to be a certain version of proper time, or rather I should say a discrete proper time, because we are sitting on these triangulations, discrete proper time, and forbid a causal or causality violating, I could also say, so-called baby universes. So the baby universes, which I'll explain to you now, are the source of all trouble, as it appears. So let us look at the following. So the typical histories we'll be summing over now in this causal version of solving the model, they have a global notion of proper time and kind of a global slicing, as we've met it in, you know, introducing kind of the 3+1 decomposition. So let me make a little picture. So time is now going that way. Let it be now my proper time, not any arbitrary coordinate time. And let my spatial slices be compact, and I let them be represented by kind of a circle, my three geometry. So here is my three geometry G3 at time t equal to 0. And well, now I allow this to fluctuate in some way. And let me now pick, so I'm still thinking now of having this triangulated, so before I take a continuum limit. So I have now a slicing. And I arrange all my building blocks so that they lie, so kind of they extrapolate between slices. So kind of they go between adjacent slices of time t and time t plus 1. And up here I have some g3 of some final time, capital T. So that's just a sketch. So you triangulate them kind of in sandwiches. So this is what the geometries are. That is a general kind of CDT history you'll be summing over. And that should be contrasted with the geometries that contribute in the Euclidean way of doing the sum. So of course, in the Euclidean way of doing the sum, you don't have any notion of time or causality. So basically, what your geometries are, they're just arbitrary gluings, only subject to a local manifold condition and subject to having fixed an overall topology of these four-dimensional building blocks. What one can do is, by brute force, start somewhere, identify some boundary geometry, and work one's way in steps and superimpose by brute force some notion of time. So just imitating kind of this process here. And what one then finds, what a typical history looks like with such a kind of a brute force imposed time, it'll look like this. So this is time again. I have here my kind of time slicing, and then it would kind of continue, you know, in these branches. And you see what you see. So that would be a typical history appearing in the Euclidean approach. And well, what you see here is, firstly, if I now think of that as a geometry evolving in time, its topology will in general change. Yes? Because let me just cut it, whatever, say here. You see, all of a sudden, it has a piece here, and it has a piece over here. Right? And well, so these things, these outgrowths, they are called baby universes. And what's more, well, why would you never consider such a thing in classical GR? Well, of course, because it doesn't have a topology that is of the form of a product, a Cartesian product. But well, more specifically, what's wrong with these geometries? Well, they have points where causality is violated. So everywhere, well, this is probably still, there might be one here, these points, or there might be even extended regions, they are causality violating. And why is that? Because it turns out that, well, the metric, well, there are, in these points, the light cones are not well defined. And why is that? Well, if you think of it as kind of as an embedding picture, in these points, see kind of the tangent space to this object here is horizontal. So everywhere here, you know, my light cones go like this. If I get to a point like that, well, the light cone doesn't know whether to go left or go right. Now, if you look then at what happens to the entries of the metric G mu nu, yeah, you will see it has at least some zeros in the spectrum. So if you diagonalize it, you will find it has zero eigenvalues. And it means the light cone is not well defined. It means causal structure is not well defined. And I just want to emphasize, this is by no means, this is something very, very serious. Classically, you might say, just at a little point, you know, the causality structure is ill-defined. Well, it's a very serious thing. So classically, these are absolutely disallowed. And of course, on macroscopic cells, we've never observed any such thing to happen. And well, one more way of seeing that there is something very wrong with this type of geometry, with its causality properties, is the following. It's called, what is it called? I forget now what the phenomenon is called. But anyway, imagine you are an observer just traveling in here. Now, you see, here, the future, all the future is still open to you in the form of, you know, having kind of causal light rays that you might emit, that might propagate into here. Now, once you've gone past this here, at some point, you will, in a discontinuous manner, lose part of your potential future, which kind of vanishes up this baby universe once you've got past this. So, and if you think about it, that it's a very bizarre thing to happen. So that's called causal discontinuity. So classically, these are, you know, you wouldn't touch them ever, this type of geometry. It's totally unphysical. Now, in the quantum theory, we don't a priori know which histories we should be summing over. And it's already clear that there will be very many non-classical objects that enter into the sum. So a priori, I have no really way of arguing for or against these structures. But of course, what you can do, you can just, if you're able to do it, you can say do the path integral, including those and excluding those, and just see what difference it makes. Okay, and this one can do. So when this was proposed by myself and collaborators, just to do it this way, the first thing we looked at was two dimensions. And what we then found is that this model can be exactly solved, like the Euclidean model could, this Liouville gravity. And of course, the Liouville gravity, it has all these baby universes in it. And well, they can both be exactly solved, and they lead to just distinct theories that can in no manner be mapped onto each other by some simple prescription like substituting a T with an IT or something. So they're just genuinely different objects. The observables have this same observables have just different spectra, different eigenvalues. So they are genuinely distinct. And that was a very interesting message, because for the first time, one had an explicit model of dynamical geometry, non-perturbative geometry, where one could say, look, signature plays a big role. If the signature is, you know, positive definite, I'm just summing over Euclidean objects, I get a totally different result from what I do when I impose a causal structure on any one of the virtual histories contributing to the path integral. And of course, then, after that, you'll try that in higher dimensions. Does it hopefully also there make a crucial difference? And indeed, it. This is what comes out. So, now, how is one able now to study these causal models, which certainly still have kind of the factor of I up in the exponential? So what I told you, OK, in two dimensions, these things are kind of manageable to solve. This here can, it's just solved by combinatorial methods or by matrix model methods on the Liouville side. Here, you also basically have a combinatorial way of exactly performing the state sum and studying its continuum limit. In three dimensions, there are still a few things you can do analytically, but you don't get terribly far. In four dimensions, currently, the only thing you can do is to numerically simulate, I mean, to perform Monte Carlo simulations of this superposition of states. Now you might say, oh, well, that's very disappointing. You know, can't I do it analytically? Well, of course, one should keep in mind that there is no theory of non-perturbative quantum gravity that can calculate anything. So certainly not analytically, but you are in a situation, you have a great, great advantage if your particular way of doing quantum gravity is amenable to numerical simulations, because in general, this will be the only means by which you will be able to extract any information about this model at all. So even to understand whether it has, you know, any chance of, say, producing a correct classical limit, well, you know, usually you write down kind of some, you manipulate your formal expressions there, but you don't have any kind of quantitative way of really testing out. Well, does what comes out, does it have a chance of being right, or is it just way off? So what I explained to you with this Euclidean, the degeneracies of this Euclidean model, if people hadn't had computer simulations available to test, you know, once the hypothesis had formed, aha, maybe there's something wrong with these, maybe they just describe branched polymers, if one hadn't been able to test this explicitly with the help of simulations, people probably would be staring at these formal path integrals today still and not understanding that it's completely uninteresting for quantum gravity. So that's actually, I want to bring across, that's a really important tool to try and understand non-perturbative properties of the theory. And this is very analogous to what happens in lattice QCD. But of course, some of the non-perturbative properties of the theory are rather well understood, but with the help of doing Monte Carlo simulations. Okay, now, so we have to do this. And for that, again, one is in trouble if one just has these complex phase factors floating around. So, and then the nice thing, however, is that these particular histories one is summing over, they possess a nice Wick rotation. So each of them, you know, you give me the Minkowski, well, the triangulation with the Minkowski building blocks, I map it to unique Euclidean geometry. Essentially, by just flipping, by assigning whatever was here a time-like assignment for a length variable, I flip it to one for a space-like length assignment. And that turns out, also at the same time, to convert exactly the e to the is of the Lorentzian theory to the e to the minus s of then the corresponding Wick rotating Euclidean geometry. So that's an extremely nice property that one cannot, and it's a prescription that is not in any way we've been able to find, can be mapped on a prescription in the continuum, because there no general Wick rotation exists, and one would love to have such a prescription, just exactly to relate Lorentzian and Euclidean. But so my first statement is this causal dynamical triangulations, histories, they do possess a well-defined Wick rotation. And now you could say, well, but aren't you now then back to the Euclidean case? No, we aren't, because the set of Wick rotated Lorentzian geometries turns out to be a small subset, as a matter of fact, kind of a subset of measure zero in the space of all Euclidean geometries. So this is what turns out. This is what happens. So Wick rotating my entire set of Lorentzian triangulated spacetimes gives rise to Euclidean spacetimes, which are a proper subset of kind of the set of Euclidean objects. And basically, I mean, because you've eliminated all these things with the kind of baby universes branching out in the time direction, and there are very, very, very many of those. So they actually, the problem, if you like, they overwhelm the path integral and make it have all these degenerate properties in the Euclidean case. Okay, now, so these computer simulations are quite crucial. So of course I have a very little time to sketch you, you know, what has been done. So I'll just highlight some results that have now come out of this construction. So we are now summing over these Lorentzian objects, and then see what happens. And to see what happens means you evaluate particular observables in the path integral. So yes, I'm going to write this down in a second. So the nicest and a kind of key result to come out of this is that actually now it turns out that you do find kind of a ground set of geometry that comes about, is kind of dynamically generated from this dynamical principle you have. You are implementing the path integral. So what it does, and you rotate it into Euclidean signature, and what the dynamics is determined by is kind of an interplay of kind of the weights you've put in, which still know about the Einstein action, and kind of the measure or the entropy of states. So how often is a given value of the weight, how often does it occur? So how many geometries give rise to that weight? So that's entropy, that's the measure. So, and there is a very complicated interplay in this highly kind of non-perturbative region, so where you're also taking this continuum limit and your geometries become extremely wiggly, that leads then to an effect, something like an effective action. And it turns out that an extremum, or in this case a minimum of that effective action, is what you can study with your Monte Carlo simulation. So that is like the ground state of geometry. So the vacuum, so the mother of all vacua, namely the one where you've taken into account the quantum fluctuation of space-time itself. And the very interesting thing here that comes out is that this now seems actually to have a nice classical limit. So kind of the solution, in the sense I just described to you, that comes out of studying this model, seems to have at least some nice properties that are compatible with a specific solution, cosmological solution to the classical Einstein equations, on large scales only. So let me summarize it by writing it like this. So what happens here, what one finds here, is a dynamical generation. So that's just mean, you know, finding a solution to the quantum dynamical principle one has set up of an extended quantum universe. So it's no longer infinite dimensional or two dimensional. Actually, on large scales, it turns out to be a four dimensional. And of course, the story is slightly more complicated. I should say the state sum is still dependent on the kind of the bare coupling constants you put in. So what you get actually is you get a whole phase diagram. And only if you choose your bare couplings to lie within a certain region, you find this nice quantum universe, extended quantum universe. There are other phases of the model in which you rederive kind of analogs of these highly degenerate phases you found in the Euclidean models. Okay. So on large scales, now, so what is this? On large scales, it looks like a De Sitter space. Now, how do I now extract geometric properties that enable me to make such a statement? So I have this kind of quantum superposition simulated by my computer, and I look at it for, you know, larger and larger volume cutoffs n, and first, and I try then to extrapolate kind of in a well-defined manner, what the limit n to infinity would entail. So that that is where I then try to understand what the physics is. So now, understanding what geometry this giant superposition has, one has to evaluate specific observables. So one observable one is evaluating that leads one to make this statement is one looks at, one measures the three volume as a function of proper time. And of course, since you're in the quantum theory, one has to evaluate this on the ensemble, on this entire superposition. So it's an expectation value. So that is three volume of a spatial slice. So if I write this down, so how do I compute expectation values of things in the path integral? I insert them under the integral. So and I, of course, normalize them. So that's what you do, normalize this. And then this is now just schematically my kind of my sum over all triangulated spacetimes. This is like what I had before. And I simply kind of insert in the trace, that's how it's sometimes phrased, I insert this particular observable I'm interested in. Yes. So weight with weights that are, again, my regex action. So what one finds here, if one does this, one finds that this is proportional to cosine cubed of this proper time, just up to some constant proportionality factor, which I'm calling C here. And you ask yourself, OK, what is this characteristic of? Well, it's what you would get looking at Euclidean de Sitter space in four dimensions. Of course, we have rotated, so we are sitting in the Euclidean domain. And so what you can fit it to with very great accuracy, this kind of, that's what I call a volume profile of this form, you can fit it to a Euclidean de Sitter space in proper time coordinates. And in the continuum, this metric has the following form. So C squared, cosine squared, T over C, D omega 3 squared. So this is just the volume element on the unit 3 sphere. And you see, of course, that is like, it's a cosmological metric. And this here is your scale factor. And of course, the scale factor is nothing but giving you the volume the universe has. In this case, it's a compact universe that is really around S3. So the only thing that changes over time is its volume. So it starts out at zero volume. You know, it goes up to maximum, and then it collapses down to minimum volume. And of course, what is Euclidean de Sitter space? It's just a four sphere. So it's a round four sphere. So what you're looking at is really the volume profile of a round four sphere, where here, I mean, this is proper time. So, and every section is a three sphere, is a round three sphere. And all that changes is just the size of that three sphere as a function of time. So this is what is encoded in this metric. Okay, so, and as far as I'm aware, so this is an extremely nice result. So it's like you started with this non-perturbative, background-independent superposition of states, and it is really very non-perturbative. So it's really true what I claimed there. When you look individually at the histories that contribute, they are extremely non-classical. So they are really very, very singular. They have their curvature blows up for example. So they're very nasty objects. Nevertheless, the quantum superposition manages to generate something that on large scales resembles a classical spacetime. So that is kind of what you would have hoped in the best of all worlds to happen, and that really does happen. Now, that's kind of recovery of the classical limit. Of course, that is by no means a proof that, you know, this is the right theory and the classical limit, everything is right with this classical limit. More things one has to do in order to verify this. But I would say it just looks extremely encouraging. So before we wrap up, let us look very briefly at what happens on short scales, because that's, of course, the region where the interesting new physics is we are looking for, right? Quantum gravity, where we want to look for what are now real effects of quantum gravity. Can we eventually relate them kind of to phenomenology in the real world? So let us look at how you can get an idea, at least, of the kind of things that happen on short scales. Now, here we're getting back to this notion of extracting kind of effective dimensions of a system. So you see, someone hands you some space. You have no idea what it is. It's maybe not a classical space. I mean, how do you characterize it? And a rough way of characterizing an unknown kind of geometric object is by these various dimensions. So the Hausdorff dimension I have already talked about. The Hausdorff dimension relates a volume to linear extension. Now, there is another notion of dimension which you can learn about by looking at a diffusion process. So I hand you this unknown space, and what you do, you set up a diffusion process. So like something that's spreading in this unknown space of space-time. So like having letting a drop of ink fall into a bucket of water. And what you then do, you study how the ink cloud grows as a function of diffusion time. So the diffusion time is kind of an external parameter that just describes, you know, little steps. Okay, what happens from kind of one second to the other in terms of your diffusion time. Now, so what you do, this will be very a short argument. So you set up a diffusion process. So here's my bucket of water, which now, of course, is an ensemble of dynamically generated kind of a dynamically triangulated spacetimes. You let a drop of ink fall in, and you now observe kind of how this cloud kind of spreads as a function of diffusion time. So you're looking at kind of the volume of the ink cloud as a function of diffusion time. So sigma is my external diffusion time. And if kind of to leading order, this behaves like sigma to the ds over 2, you call, and you're extracting ds that way, ds is the so-called spectral dimension which characterizes this process. So ds is called spectral dimension. And why does this 1/2 appear here? Well, because kind of the little ink droplets, say, of course, they are random walkers. They don't go straight ahead, but they wiggle around in a minute. That kind of the typical linear distance they will have traveled is proportional to square root of sigma. So this is kind of a volume. And this is, so you can set up such a process. And it turns out you can set up this process on the ensemble of triangulated geometries and extract what ds is. So let me just draw one last little diagram. This one can just measure. So this is ds, and this is sigma. In units, we're not going to go into. So what one now measures in the in the computer, one really sets up this diffusion and then one extracts this DS. So what one finds here is a curve that looks like this. So here is an interval within which you can measure this. Here is 4. Here is around, here is 2 somewhere. Now, then you fit it kind of to a curve that asymptotes, and then you find that on large distances, kind of this asymptotes with great accuracy to 4 within your numerical accuracy, and for small distances, well, it comes out to about 2, not quite, so DS. That's what one extrapolates from computer. Now I have to look this up. 0.1. And sigma going to 0, you're measuring it only in a finite interval away from infinity and 0, of course, comes out to be 1.85 plus minus a quarter kind of error bars. Now, this is very curious. Now, letting the diffusion process run for a long time probes long distance properties of your spacetime or your ensemble. And letting it run for just a short time will probe short scale properties. So what we're seeing here is very nice kind of recovery of expected classical behavior on large scales. When you let this process really run for a long time, then the diffusion feels a four-dimensional space. And however, when you come to smaller distances, clearly this behaves in a totally unexpected way from a classical point of view. So that is a strong indication of kind of non-classical behavior. And if I put kind of physical units in, you'll see here, well, we are here in kind of 10 Planck lengths. That's somewhere around here. So this is very, very close to the Planckian regime that this thing happens. This is just kind of a glimpse of what happens here. So one, of course, has to understand precisely where this comes from. So this approach is not the only approach which finds this. So it's an extremely intriguing coincidence with a calculation that people can make in a kind of renormalization group treatment of gravity, of quantum gravity. And there's a result due to Lausch and Reuter. It's interesting because the method is entirely orthogonal on what is done here from 2005, which basically compute exactly the same behavior for quantum gravity. And I should say the results here are due to, so the De Sitter results are due to myself and collaborators. Ambian, Görlich, Jurkiewicz, and myself, 2005. That's a kind of the emergence of the De Sitter space result, and these are a little earlier, these results. Okay. So that's just kind of giving you a glimpse of what happens. Again, that is cutting a long story very short, as I had to do when talking to you about loop quantum gravity. Now here, there are some very encouraging and interesting looking results. Clearly, this is an ongoing story. So it's by no means wrapped up, and it's by no means any foolproof demonstration that this is the right theory of quantum gravity. But it does certainly look very promising. One has to look further at what happens with classical limit. Can one, for instance, rederive Newton's law kind of from scratch, just from kind of this quantum setup? That is an extremely challenging task. Again, can one analyze metacoupled systems? One can couple matter without any problems to those, but what are the observables one wants to study there? And perhaps can one verify, as people here, in working in this renormalization group approach, claim, based on their findings, the existence of a non-trivial fixed point of the renormalization group flow in the ultraviolet, so which might underlie the fact that there is actually a well-defined quantum gravity series that exists there. So, well, my belief is kind of the path integral in this type of non-perturbative studies is the way to go. Other variants exist, which I haven't talked about, spin foam models that want to be kind of a covariant version of loop quantum gravity, and things like quantum causal sets. I haven't talked about them for lack of time. Also, they are by far not as developed as kind of the results I presented you in this particular way of doing things. But of course, one should keep an eye on all of them. Okay, well, that really brings me to the end of my lecture. Running over a little, just a little. I hope you've enjoyed our excursion together. And who knows, maybe one of you will end up contributing to, you know, to push this very exciting subject forward. And, you know, good luck with the rest of your course and what comes up.